Welcome to Violent Delights, a Westworld podcast, where your hosts, Andrew Cersini,
Dwayne D,
and Tosin Anofawakan.
We just watched the first episode of Westworld's third season, titled Parse Domine. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. We're going to dive into the after talk, but before we do, we have some online spots you can get in contact with us. You can write us or email us a voice memo at hbowestworldpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at hbowestworldpod or just hashtag Violent Delights. Our Facebook page is Westworld Podcast. You can add us on iTunes. Please like us and leave a review. That's how we get noticed for the show. Welcome back to season three. It's been 2 years.
It's always 2 years.
Yeah, it's nuts. And it feels
time to get it right.
Yeah. No, I'm glad. I'm glad that they made the time to get it right. I'm glad that it's eight seasons or eight episodes, so it's short and sweet, right? But I think that allows them to build, to craft a tight, condensed, well-told story rather than 10 or 12 episodes.
Yeah, I hate stretched out stuff.
This episode is written by Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan and directed by Jonathan Nolan. And before we dive into the particulars about this episode, Dwayne, why don't you give us a brief recap of this episode?
You got it. Here's the recap. Cold open, Dolores steals into the house of a powerful tech magnate and uses her knowledge of him from Westworld and the outside world's computers to extort him, so she's flush with cash for her nefarious enterprise. There's a new opening sequence. We see these infographics called divergences, whereupon you have a circle that's like a kind of graphic thing, and then out of it bounces a little node, and the node has some information about how something's different from the norm at a certain location. It's very interesting. We meet Caleb. He's a veteran of a conflict that we're not privy to. He suffered some post-traumatic stress, and he's in therapy while trying to make ends meet as a construction worker. While many people have some sort of cognitive implant called a limbic turned on, like Jerry, who was the tech magnate that Dolores stole the money from, or Caleb's mom, Caleb chooses to keep his off. Caleb also freelances in criminal acts as a blockchain-based, via a blockchain-based dark web app called Rico, which is named for the criminal act that prosecutors go after when they see a criminal activity that's organized. We see New Hale, that is, Hale was taken out last season, and she's back this season as a host, but nobody knows that except for us, the viewers, and her cohorts. And she meets with the board of Delos, and she uses the Man in Black's machine proxy to take Delos private instead of being traded publicly on the markets, because private companies don't have to make regular filings with regulators. And if you're a robot trying to take over the world, that's pretty helpful. Meanwhile, Bernard, he's hiding in some remote industrial meat farm. Accents are from all over the place. We don't exactly know where. He calls himself Armand Delgado, and he's gone from kind of a bird-chested behavioral coder to a muscled meat processor. He remains aware of his host's nature and runs diagnostics on himself multiple times a day. We know that because he hasn't seen Dolores for 92 days, but he's run 300-plus diagnostics on himself. He's found out by two of his coworkers in the meat processing plant, and they try to extort him. He subdues them and then leaves to find and stop Dolores. Meanwhile, Dolores is living as a woman named Lara. She's the new lover of a man named Dempsey, the heir and CEO of Insight, a tech company that's in control of traffic and people's careers, and it's just omnipresent and pervasive in the America of the 2050s. He's handled by a man named Connells, who represents the interests of Insight's partners. And Dolores' goal is to find out all she can about Insight's artificial intelligence, and is using Dempsey by following him and spying on him to gain that knowledge. Her alias is uncovered by Connells, Dempsey's handler, who tries to kill her. Having anticipated this, Dolores is heavily injured, but she manages not only to kill Connells, but to replace him with a host of her choosing. We don't know what chestnut's in there either, but that's the recap. That's what happened in the episode. It gave us a lot of thrills. There was a lot of violence in this episode.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I think people were
excited about it. Did you delight in them?
Well said.
Well, what was your, before we jump into the particulars, what was your guys' opinion of the episode in general as far as the way the narrative was told in comparison to episodes from season one and season two?
I mean, I'll jump on that.
Yeah.
The first thing I'll say is, in season one, it took us a couple episodes to realize that there were multiple timelines going on. In season two, they had multiple timelines, but they were far more subtle. So season one's timelines are like 30 years. Season two's timelines are like, this happened 14 days ago, but this is happening now. And that, I think, confused a lot of people watching the show. Here, it seems pretty straightforward.
Things right?
move from A to B to C. And while I think it was refreshing, I was a little sad that, the part of my brain that is constantly trying to decode what's going on in the show was like, wait a minute, they're giving it to us straight. I don't know what to do with that.
You missed the puzzle box aspect?
Right. A little bit. That said, I have been critical of some of the aspects of the puzzle box because I feel like the pieces don't always line up.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have here is, if this is a five-season work, then season three is one of the seasons in the climax of it. So this attempt by the hosts to take over the world or do what they will is one that's going to have to be depicted very clearly. And it has a lot of drama in it already. So you don't necessarily need to have some sort of specialized back and forth, confusing or mystery there. It's just a question of how will they uncover what they need to uncover in order to get the power they need to get to do what they want to do. And we've all been waiting to see this level of engagement. So yeah, I think that's it's totally fine that they're doing it this way. And I think they wanted to keep the show fresh. Why not?
I think you definitely don't need to have any sort of ongoing mystery element. I think, some of that waned in season two, and for a lot of fans out there, there was a bit of a detriment of, hey, are they still trying to do the same thing over and over again? And I watched my first watching of this was with roommates and other people, and one of them remarked how they literally could have started with this episode as its brand new show without even any of the historical information that's provided. It kind of stands alone, and you can understand that theme given that we're so divergent from where, the movie initially took us as well as where season one took us. So I do like this sort of straightforward narrative. And overall, I think as an episode, it worked pretty well. It was pretty engaging. Pretty curious to try and figure out what was going on and just follow the typical through line.
Yeah. Oh, well, one last thing I'll say is that it was kind of like a soft reboot of the show almost, right?
Yeah.
Different setting. If you think about the actors that were in the very first season, you're not going to see a lot of them, right? Like Felix and Sylvester, all these kind of characters. It's got core actors in a new setting and almost a new time. So it is a little bit like a reboot of the whole thing, but you've got what you need to get it going. So
I think a lot of that might be born out of, there was some open criticism of the showrunners after season two that the show was getting a little bit too into itself and too mired in that sort of puzzle box aesthetic, where it wasn't a more of a lean back experience. So I think that this soft reboot, as you refer to it, is an attempt to sort of regain a fresh audience.
Yeah, I think it might work. I mean, my wife is, I don't want to say struggling through, but she's, we have two kids, but she's going through season two. She's like, wait, what's going on? And then the season three episode came on today, and she was paying attention to it, and she didn't have any trouble,
Nice.
Given that she didn't really see all of season two, that's a big thing. Because I remember Joss Whedon said this about Buffy.
Yeah.
One of the issues that he had with it into, seasons five and six and seven was that before the episode, he'd had to lose all this time to last time on Buffy, where they had this giant recap, which is like 4 or 5 minutes long. Like, what the hell? So you want to avoid that if you can, right? You want to have a show that people can just turn on and watch. At the same time, you want to have an arc, right? You want to have a continuity.
Right.
So it's a balancing act. And I think that we have a chance here to sort of reset that. And I'm excited about it.
So let's jump into the details. First of all, we have to we're looking at a whole new set of main titles, brand new opening title sequence. Every season of Westworld opens with a new iteration of the main titles, and this is not an exception. So let me break down sort of what we see on the screen, and then punctuate it with like our thoughts about what is going on thematically there. So we open on the wings of an eagle soaring into sort of this this landscape. We see the host making machine from seasons one and season two is now making that eagle. And then we see what looks to be cellular division. And then we see this.
It's mitosis.
Yeah. So we see this body. Then we see this host body floating upwards. And we don't see what it's floating upwards towards. We cut to a shot of what looks like a jet engine testing the airflow of this eagle. We see this floating body now mirrored with a sinking one. We cut to a shot of the eagle in flight flying towards an eye. And then we see, this is an interesting shot. We could keep intercutting to this shot of this floating body and the sinking body. Now we see these floating bodies and sinking bodies touch, and their touch recalls the famous painting, Da Vinci painting of the creation of Adam. Mm-hmm. And then we see that touch being broken by the ripples of the surface of the water.
It's almost as if you think two units are coming together, but in fact what you're realizing that you're seeing is a reflection in water, because it's almost surprising when, you know, they go to touch and turns into ripples, right? Because at first, right, just some people are going toward one another.
Yeah, and then we say, and I might have misspoken. I don't know if it was Da Vinci. I think it was Michelangelo who did.
Michelangelo, yep.
Yeah.
It was Michelangelo, the creation of Adam on the Sistine Chapel.
Got it. Okay, so then we see the bodies now as one body floating up towards the reflection of the water surface, and then that hand rises up from beneath the water surface. And then we cut to a shot of a circular shot of a dandelion with its spores floating off into the breeze, representing pollination, I think. Then those spores start to encircle a globe and become what appears to be Data, which represents the Rehoboam sphere that we see later on in the episode.
It's literally a black and white picture of the that sphere.
Right. So, and then we see a face rising up from the water. This is the same intercut shot of the host in the water. And as we see that, we see its reflection sinks downward. So it's like an interchange of figures. What was once the host under the water is now rises up to the surface. And what was once in the reflection in the surface is now sinking down towards beneath the water. We see another shot of, and I think that we'll get to that in a second. We see another shot of cellular division. We see an eagle soaring into the sun. The host body floats upwards as we cut to the sinking reflection of its former self. And this is where something interesting happens. The sinking reflection of its former self, the face opens on that body, revealing a mechanical structure inside. What I take that, how I interpret that is the emergence of a new species as the mechanical shadow of its ancestor falls away. So it's shedding off its mechanical forebearers to in place of its new organic self. It's literally the origin of a new species from the old species, I think, is what that represents.
I mean, there's so much here. I mean, even if we go back to the early parts, right? So like if we go back to the water, right? Mm-hmm. As that head emerges, it's a lot like baptism. Like she's being born again. Mm-hmm, and this mm-hmm. is, you know, it's they chose a female body instead of a male body by the shape of it. And if you think back to Dolores, right, throughout seasons one and two, season one especially, there's this focus on Dolores kind of being a representation of Alice in Wonderland, right? As she breaks the surface of the water, this unnamed host, it dawned on me that, you know, it's pretty not subtle representation of Through the Looking Glass.
Right, you know? Right.
That's the sequel to Alice in Wonderland when she breaks into a different world. That's exactly what's happening here. Now, when I think about the eagle, I mean, it's a pretty
obvious symbol. I mean, the only thing I got from that is the eagle representative of the idea of freedom or liberty.
That's exactly right. So I think it's a pretty obvious idea of power and liberty, and the idea that they're not free.
Yeah, and taking flight, right?
Yeah, because that's the thing about eagles. Like they hang on the wind. They can go wherever they want. They're all over the country, and that's kind of what I got out of that. It was pretty powerful. Now the dandelions for me were interesting because dandelions, they do seed everywhere, and you cannot stop. I mean, I've plucked all the dandelion yellow flowers from, you know, the front of my home, and they always come back because they seed everything. So that is true. You can the idea that you can seed it is definitely there, but I also feel like dandelions are also wishes, right? And it's one of those things that
interesting.
You know, children blow dandelions to make a wish. And it's one of those things, like this series is about these people wanting their freedom, wanting you know, to not be enslaved, wanting to be free of man, possibly taking over the world. So, it's insidious. It gets everywhere, all that stuff. The bird flying into the jet engine is interesting because it looks like it's an air blower to test aerodynamics, presumably.
Yeah.
It does look like an eye, like an opening iris at one point. That was interesting to me. I don't know if that's a thing or not, but I thought that was interesting visually. When it's kind of like burning up, it reminded me of Icarus, the old story about the child who had the wax wings, the fake wings. And let's face it, it's a fake bird. It got too close to the sun, too close to the heat source. And the wax melted, and Icarus fell.
Is that foreshadowing for the season?
Potentially.
Because, I mean, let's think about it. I mean, Dolores, when she's taking over Jerry's stuff and she's, you know, taking out Connells and all that stuff, there's definitely something to be said here about her hubris, right? Like, I'm this machine. The whole show, basically, she's like, I'm going to take over that outside world. You're one being, and you want to take over the outside world. Now, granted, you've got some tools that nobody else has. You can hack into people's stuff. You can do all these other things like that. But at the same time, there's a hubris there that we have to watch out for. And for me, seeing the interchange between the being on the top of the water versus the being in the bottom of the water, it's almost like she, you know, if the creation of Adam is God creating this being that can, unlike the angels, it can feel and make decisions, maybe that being itself will supplant God. And when it does that, maybe what's left of it, its mortal coil, will fall away, right? So I don't know. But that's kind of what I was feeling.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, you see a lot of that depiction of, especially in stories and movies. Let's take Lord of the Rings for one. You know, don't look in the water. You might get pulled down. Different things pulling in the water. And then I believe there's also been some movies where I can't remember the name, but I feel like it's this old mermaid movie or 90s movie where they pulled you into the water, came out and reemerged as that individual. So sort of taking over their position in land. And we know that Dolores has these sort of strong beliefs and strong opinions in how she wants to change and adapt the world to be better for, you know, her species and her kind. I do worry that, as you foresaw with the foreshadowing, that her ambitions may get the best of her.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, and I feel like that almost ties into the first scene in this episode where we see Dolores in the water emerging out of it. And then,
speaking of water, hello, Phoebe Tonkin has a guest appearance in this episode. Right? Uh-huh. Right, guys? Phoebe Tonkin, don't you guys remember H2O, Just Add Water?
No.
That talk.
Are you serious?
Oh my god, okay. H2O, Just Add Water is this like mid-2000s, mid-noughts,
I'm well aware
series.
Of it.
And it's about these three girls who, when the moon is up, they're in some moon pool and they turn into to mermaids.
Is she really in this episode?
She's in the episode. She is the paramour of the guy, the accented, the non-American accented guy
who's
trying to talk to Dempsey. And she's like, she's the one, after the discussion about the part of the brain that is designed for whatever guy, she's the one that says, it's not like he hasn't been drawn by something that's an inch and a half before. That's her line.
That's hilarious.
And Phoebe Tonkin, I mean, she is the best part of H2O, just that water, I'm just saying. And so if you want to go back and watch some fun teen comedy.
Should you go back and watch that? I don't
know. All right, let's get back on track here. So the last ominous shot of these main titles are, as in season one and season two, we see this Vitruvian man machine sinking into liquid. Season one, it was white liquid. Season two, black liquid. In this season, the liquid is red. So I'm expecting...
blood. Yeah, I mean, that really struck out to...
The blood of your enemies, you mean?
Well, it struck out to me. It struck out to my wife a lot. She goes, I haven't seen red in that before.
No.
And, I mean, birth is bloody, and revolution is bloody.
Revolution. That's, you know, I was thinking both red for blood for violence, but also red is the color of revolution.
Yeah, that's now that you mention it, one thing that's interesting about this episode, and we'll talk more about the color gradients used, but there are a few items in this episode that were red, right? We noticed her with Dolores with a red skirt. Mm-hmm. We noticed
it was a red dress with black top on top of it.
Yes. We noticed Caleb with the red lunch box or toolbox. We noticed the robot as well too, so it's interesting. I wonder if we'll see more introduction of that color as we get further
as we get further into revolution, supposedly.
Yeah, the Westworld palette, with the exception of what Maeve wore, is very natural colors.
Earthy,
right? Yeah, it's very earthy. I mean, Dolores wore blue, Maeve wore red, and what's her name? The one that used to work for Maeve all last season, she wore white. She was lobotomized.
Yeah.
I forgot her name, but Andy, you really like that character. In any event, it's interesting to see red celebrities.
Clementine Pennyfeather.
Clementine, that's right. And we are in the real world, and the real world has more color than the stylized world of Westworld. Literally and figuratively. So figuratively, there's more going on in the real world. I'm surprised that Dolores isn't a bit more shocked with everything that's going on. I mean, I know this world is it's a lot. It looks like a lot neater than ours. I mean, they've got computers controlling traffic, computers controlling where people work and stuff like that. But at the same time, the world is a messy place. Like, there are homeless people, maybe. I don't know what it's like in 30 years, but there's all this stuff going on, and I'm surprised that she's not a little bit more taken aback by how messy the world is compared to, like, Westworld, where she was totally able to take over, right?
Let's get into the salient points about this episode, where we break down some of the most important things that we noticed in this particular episode. Let's start with the title. Okay, so the title, Parse Domine, comes from a Roman Catholic antiphon?
So it's like a chant, is kind of what
a chant.
How I'd describe the antiphon.
Yeah, yeah. So
like canting. It's like canting. Like, you ever been to like a Catholic ceremony or a Jewish ceremony? It's a cantor. It's kind of a way to sing a phrase.
So the full lyrics of this Parse Domine is reads in the English translation is, "Spare, Lord, spare your people. Be not angry with us forever." I'm not entirely sure at this point how to interpret that title in relation to this episode.
So the way I interpreted it was the first two words are just spare Lord. And we see a lot of examples here of either individuals asking someone to spare them, be it Dolores, who potentially is kind of playing God. So in one of the intro scenes, we see Jerry, the investor who, you know, asked Dolores to spare his life. And she gladly, you know, obliges to that until he tries to kill her and kills himself. And Dolores also telling Jerry's wife that she has spared her. She had saved her from the marriage that she's been in. And then we see...
Also, she's saving her from eventually dying. I mean, she... Dolores makes it clear that Jerry has a loop, and that loop involves killing an Asian wife, which is creepy. She's basically like, when she's like, I'm the person who saved you. She's like, she saved him, her, from what she thought was going to happen to her later. I mean, we saw the almost the very first thing that Jerry did was scream at her for no good reason.
Yeah.
Right? His wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, to the point where, you know, he comes into the bedroom and he's like, he's telling her, I don't want you in town anymore.
Exactly. So, it's a very controlling, abusive relationship. We get that.
It's terrible.
Yeah, the interesting thing now I think about it is in a lot of the examples we have here where there people are asking for to be spared, they ultimately end up getting killed, right? So we've got like the cow whose leg is broken that Bernard finds, and we hear that cow is going to be killed. We hear about Bernard asking the guys who are trying to extort him that, hey, stop, like, I can, like, you can't save yourself, I can help you save them. And he ends up at least knocking them out, potentially killing them. And even at the very end, you know, when Dolores ends up creating a double that kills Connors.
Connells.
You see a lot of that where there is no mercy here. Everything ends in red, right?
Yeah, not bad.
So it's the spare Lord, spare your people. Parce Domine is like a request for mercy, from whom? From the gods that are the hosts, as Dolores says at the very end of the episode, you know, the new gods are coming and they're very angry.
So the full text from Joel chapter 2, 20, verse 17 says, let the priests who minister before the Lord weep between the portico and the altar. Let them say, quote, spare your people, Lord. Do not make your inheritance an object of scorn, a byword among the nations. Why should they say among the people, where is their God? Right? So that is a... People are basically it's a prayer to God to take care of his people. And during the Bible, you know, First Testament especially, or Old Testament, God is a pretty rough being when it comes to humanity.
Sure.
He kind of becomes this, you know, feed the hungry, you know, love your neighbor during the New Testament if you're a Christian. But people are pretty worried and scared. They're constantly asking God to give them mercy. In that Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, and that's worth noting.
Let's talk about some other stuff. So, when we first run into Bernard, he's using an alias to hide out in this meat processing plant in some undetermined rural area, and that alias is Armand Delgado.
Right, and you found an anagram for that, right, Andy?
Yes. That Armand Delgado is an anagram for damaged Arnold. So,
which we know is what happened. He's sitting there with Hale in season 2, and he's basically taking funny juice fluid out of one host, shoving it into his head so he doesn't fall apart.
Yeah, yeah.
And this time he's going through the diagnostics every 2 times a day almost just to make sure that he's still working and not being hacked.
We know the Westworld writers love their anagrams. We know that they've done that before with Bernard Lowe versus Arnold Weber. So this is just another example of that. Speaking of names, so the name of Insight's core algorithm engine is called Rehoboam.
I'm just call it Re.
It's a tough thing to say for sure. Rehoboam. Rehoboam is the name of the biblical son of King Solomon, who is widely regarded as this king who is possessing great wisdom. In the Westworld season 3 date announce, which was a video that was released earlier, where we see this circular infographic that we've seen in this episode at the beginning of these chapters. we see that at some point during this timeline, a prior build of this AI circa 2039 was named Solomon. So mm-hmm. that would it would make sense that the next iteration, Solomon's offspring, would be named Rehoboam. Yeah. But it's worth noting that historically,
it hasn't been truly updated in a while, because the show takes place in the 2050s. It seems
that's correct,
and this is happening in the late 2030s. So, almost 20 years from now. And I mean, granted, OS X has been around, called OS X, even though it's very different, for 20 years. So, you know, naming conventions are different. But that was interesting to me.
It's worth noting that under Rehoboam's reign, historically, there was an uncontrollable civil war. There was a civil war that he could not control. So who knows if that's foreshadowing for the season to come.
Wait. That's definitely foreshadowing for the season to come.
I mean, I'm just putting it out there. We don't know.
I completely did not catch that, and I am glad you brought it up, because that is definitely going to be a reason why Nolan and Joy decided that this was a great name, because mm-hmm. it's otherwise unpronounceable.
Yes.
So it had to have more meaning than pronunciation.
I hope they shortcut it in future episodes, because I don't want to have to keep referring to it as Rehoboam.
No, we just call him Re.
Re. Yeah. Okay.
Solomon Jr. Re.
I thought this episode starts off narratively very interesting, in that Dolores has a very clearly stated goal that she delivers in the prologue of this episode when she's extorting Jerry, the Delos investor and former Insight employee. She says that she's going to use his money basically to kickstart the origin of a new species. So,
investment capital, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's
I mean,
her
he's
goal.
Got a ton of money. That's the thing. So yeah. Who knows how much she took. She left enough for his now widow to basically, like, you know, obviously live her life. But still, that's the thing. Not only that, she took those files, too. Those very special files.
Right. Who knows what those files do. It's also interesting to me that Dolores continues to see herself as a liberator, as she did in the first, particularly in the second season. But she says to Jerry's wife, when Jerry's wife asks her who she is, she says, "I'm the person who set you free," which is a very specific verbiage for someone who considers themselves a liberator.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting, like, if you've been following some of the meta narrative around TV today, there's this idea of, like, the savior, right? So she's not only a god, she's a savior, right? Some could go as far as to say she's a white savior because the woman she saved is Asian, but I don't think that's necessary, because it's not like the overriding thing here. But she believes that she's a savior. She's here to save people. What's interesting is that she hates humanity, and yet she's like, "I'm the person who saved you." So if she wants to take over humanity...
Well, but does she hate humanity, or does she want... Because
I think she's got a lot of reason to hate a lot of dudes in humanity. Because, like,
yes,
you know, two of these guys in this...
I mean, there's definitely a Me Too aspect.
Raped,
yeah.
Two of these guys raped her. And then, you know, what's his name? The man in black, who her friend Hale is now controlling his electronic proxy on the board. He raped her multiple times. So if I were her, I would see, like, you know, wealthy men is, like, definitely a problem.
Those guys specifically are the ones that got killed in this episode.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, on that sort of same line of I'm here to set you free. I spent this weekend rewatching a good chunk of season one mm-hmm. of Westworld. And I don't know if you guys recall, but in one of the episodes, I think it might have been episode 4, the Men in Black, right, mm-hmm. informed Lawrence during the jailbreak from the prison cell.
Uh-huh.
He's like, "What if I told you I'm here to set you free?"
Oh.
So it's kind of that similar callback that actually just clicked to me a moment ago from that rewatch when you said that. So it's a similar sort of dynamic. However,
evil people setting people free.
Well, role reversal, right? It's you know, it was a human setting a host free. Now it's a host setting a human free in the human world, right?
I didn't put those two together.
Yeah, another visual callback is when Dolores first wakes up and is starting to go down her, you know, Alice in Wonderland path. She wakes up in bed in the same position as Aaron Paul's character, Caleb. So they both awaken in that exact same position. You know, that was not happenstance. And something else that was kind of interesting to me as we see Caleb's, you know, intro monologue, intro journey as he searches who he is. Mm-hmm. You notice that he's walking between two sets of characters on this long walkway, straddling that sort of light from the sun and the dark shadow that it casts. And you see that through the course of the day, the positives that he does, but also sort of the negatives that he does against society to make money. So he is still trying to sort himself and has both dualities within himself, which is also quite interesting because at the end of the episode, we end with, you know, Dolores in his arms, mm-hmm. in underneath an overpass in complete darkness, right?
So, wow, I think Toasting just earned his paycheck.
Wait, I get paid for this?
Well, also Dolores falling into Caleb's arms mirrors the moment in season one when Dolores falls into young William's arms that kicks off his introduction to her.
Those men have the potential to be very, very dark indeed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Wow. That kind of blows my mind. That makes me think, because we saw who young William turned into. That makes mm-hmm. me wonder if Caleb is going to suffer the same fate and become this dark, evil person who basically was guided by Dolores to become that way.
Well, before you despair,
yeah.
When Dolores falls into William's hands, she falls in the light. When Dolores falls into Caleb's hands, she falls in the dark. So if there is a sort of like god of power and light of darkness, mm-hmm. then perhaps, like, you know, it's more of a Batman thing where the good guys were black.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So there's that. But moving on here.
Yeah.
We noticed in these chapters, right? We all talked about this. These divergences, they're called, and we see this system, some sort of like a system, but basically raising a flag whenever these divergences happen. There's one happening in Beihai, China, right? There's one happening in Los Angeles, right? And there's elevated scrutiny, so it's not quite a divergence, but elevated scrutiny in London, which is part of something called the UREW, which is interesting because London just exited the EU, so we don't even know what the UREW is. But what really gets me is that Dolores is in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Beihai, China, very well could be sort of attached to the Delos Island, right?
Sure.
So these kind of divergences are things to think about. I mean, obviously, they're not going to choose totally random places. But L.A. is where the majority of this episode happens. And behind China is by this Beibu Gulf, you know, on the very bottom. It's a very remote part of China, right? And the southwest coast. So it's worth noting that this machine is compiling data, presumably the way trading algorithms compile data today. They look at social media. They look at news headlines. Look at all these other things. And they notice when there is an inflection point in what's typically being spoken about in these places. So that's worth saying.
Interesting. We've gotten a little bit more about those chapter headings coming up. But in the meantime, I noticed that Caleb, when he's talking to Francis, his therapist, mentions that Francis asks him if he's still using if he's got his implant turned on. He says, no, I turned it off. The rough edges are the only thing I'm hanging on to. And I found that phrase mirrors when both Dolores and Bernard say, the pain is all I have left. You know, they both.
Isn't that what Maeve says too?
Yeah. Yeah. It is what Maeve also says when talking about her child. So Dolores, Bernard, and Maeve, all, I think they all have the offer of being relieved of their pain, and they refuse that offer because the pain is all they have left. And that's exactly what this, like this, these limbics, they smooth down the rough edges, but Caleb refuses to use them because the rough edges are the only thing I'm hanging on to, according to him.
It's like Cybok in Star Trek V. It's no good.
Don't ever mention Star Trek V on the show again.
Well, it has to do with a quote unquote God, right? Like, by the way, no one should ever see Star Trek V. Just don't do it. Don't do it.
But I think that shows us the state of mind and vulnerability that Caleb is in when he meets Dolores. It puts him in a very vulnerable place for Dolores to enter his life.
That's a really good point. So she enters his right, but it's like at the very right moment, right?
Right.
Which is interesting because you're going to talk about the algorithm, which also does the thing with like the very right people for the very right thing.
Right. So he again has this discussion with Francis, this his therapist, who is his army buddy, who we discover at the end of this episode is actually a AI therapist.
It is robot army buddy therapist.
Yeah,
which
so
is a mind job.
An AI therapist crafted from the memories and experiences of his dead army buddy. So so Francis is kind of like the audience's surrogate because Caleb is explaining to him the interchange that they have between each other. Sort of narratively explains what's going on in Caleb's life, but Caleb says to him that the system picks the right people for the right job. But some, like him, didn't make the cut. And so that brings up the idea of this algorithm, this insight algorithm, we'll just call it Re for short. This insight algorithm, Re, who is the son of Solomon, creating this algorithmically engineered caste system, because people like Caleb don't make the cut, and so they're forced to do other things to make ends meet. The algorithm somehow has been a part of society to the extent that it tells people what to do. It puts them in the right jobs, and it puts some people not in the right jobs. We see Caleb continuously bumping his head up against, you know, he goes after interview after interview after interview. He's told that he's got a strong resume, but he's just not the right fit. And you have to feel, you get the sense that that's a decision that is made by an algorithm and not by a human.
Yeah, right. I think this will come up during when we talk a little bit more on the big picture about how we see AI and making an impact in this world. What were you going to say, Dwayne?
I just think it's great in that it talks a little bit about how lots of job searches are today. Like, you know, they want you to upload your resume so they can have a computer scan through it for mm-hmm. particular keywords. Mm-hmm. And if you're an HR professional, you don't even look at the resume as much as you wait for the hits to come in from the computer. Okay, these are the ones worth looking at. We parse
right.
them for you. And that's heavy, right? That's heavy if you spent time, you know, back in the day, you'd spend time formatting that thing. You get into page setup, you change the margins. You try to put some interesting stuff in the bottom, like rock climbing or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just he's a cog in a wheel. He's a number on a piece of paper. And there are definitely during the show, we've met so many people at the top, right? We've met the Delos family. We've met the Men in Black.
Yeah.
We've met, obviously, Ford was in a very comfortable financial position. The people that were at this park were wealthy, wealthy people. And now we're seeing what Joy and Nolan openly referred to as an everyman in terms of Caleb. And when you look at Caleb, you see someone who's frustrated that he can't move up in the world. And like Tosin said, and like you said, he can't move up in the world legitimately, so he's doing it illegitimately, and, you know, at least to make the ends meet.
Yeah.
And that's a problem that this perfect society has created, the perfect society that this robot was creating. We you know, when we're in the sky taxi or whatever, you basically see them looking down, and she's like, "Didn't you guys create the traffic patterns?" And he's like, "Yeah, you know, this is." From up here, it all looks so orderly. this is the world we wanted to create, but in the real world, it's really messy, is the kind of conceit that like follows that. And what's, to me, really interesting about that whole thing is the idea that even though they've got this algorithm trying to put the perfect people in the perfect position,
yeah,
it's not working. It's not working to the point where, you know, obviously Caleb thinks it's rigged, and you've got people like Caleb and others using apps to effectively rob, murder, and kidnap because the perfect people are not in the right positions.
Moving on to another sort of salient point, we kind of covered this already about, you know, Dolores cleaning herself off in the pool before getting dressed. You know, the last time,
the real world, yeah.
Yeah, the last time we saw her, she was dead, right? She had been shot and she was bleeding, and now she's cleansed. And we've seen this dynamic with, you know, the black hat, white hat before. Well, we see, speaking of color, we see Dolores immediately dress in black. Dwayne, you picked up a bunch of this other clothing changes by Dolores, right?
Yeah, so she does wear a lot of black clothes in this episode. She wears the black dress when she's killing, well, not killing, stealing from Jerry. She wears a black dress when she's being kidnapped. She wears a black dress when she goes to meet Dempsey while he's getting the award. What was interesting, and you know, I watched this episode with my wife, and she actually pointed this out. The white dress she wears in the Sky Taxi, she's actually, like, to look at it, it's got these three different like kind of lines across the top, which is reminiscent of the Westworld logo when it changes from the W into the three lines to represent Westworld season three. The black dress that turns into a gold dress similarly has interesting architecture toward the bodice at the top, and that also is reminiscent of the kind of like Westworld W. But when she's getting attacked, when she's being kidnapped, she is in a dress that definitely has a straight up W on top, like in terms of its shape, and that was really interesting. What was also interesting to me is that, you know, you've got Evan Rachel Wood, who is by, I think, no stretch of the imagination, one of like Hollywood's beauty standards in terms of, like, you know, she's tall, she's blonde, she's lithe, and, you know, all these things. And she's playing a robot that is a person who doesn't change shape the way humans do and all this stuff. And yet when she's about to get out into the room and talk to Dempsey about, hey, you can trust me, whatever, she's putting on this dress and she's like tugging it to get it into fit properly. And it's hilarious to me because it's like, if a robot can't fit these dresses properly, then how is a regular person supposed to fit these dresses?
Just don't design dresses for hosts, for Westworld hosts.
They just design dresses for anybody. It's like, no matter what you are, you cannot catch up to beauty standards. And it's interesting that even the 2250s, a robot can't fit into a dress. That's all I'm saying.
Let's talk about another aspect here, these limbics that we heard referred to in this episode. And we see it at several points in the episode. We see in the prologue, before Jerry goes to bed, he takes one of these limbics and he connects to an app to help sort of meditate himself into a sleep. We see at one point when Caleb is visiting his mother in the hospital, she's taking one of these limbics as a therapeutic. And we see when Caleb goes to this party, one of the partygoers is taking an illegal beta limbic, and he's basically having a bad trip. And he broke the controller that controlled the limbic. These limbics
that was definitely reminiscent of the Watchmen, when she took all of those pills for nostalgia,
and
they kind of broke her brain for a little while,
so yeah,
a little bit like that.
Yeah, so these limbics are seem to be a connected, like, nano that you swallow, and it's connected to an app. It's used to medicate and level moods. And doing a little research, on the insightinc.com or the insightinc.com site, which is like a tie-in to the show, they've updated their site to include the fact that they manufacture these limbics. It's metatextual. It's not really in the show context itself, but it does.
It's real content worth checking out if you want that that little extra about the show, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it does sort of inform. I don't think it's a little bit of flavor. It's a little bit of world building. I don't think it's necessary to the narrative of the story, but it's interesting to see this level of world building and how it informs what the way people medicate themselves to sort of suppress their own anxieties.
I was going to say it's sad, but it isn't really when you think about all the stuff we do today.
Yeah.
That just seems like, why do you need that? You know what I mean? It's like, okay, I'm wearing this thing around my wrist so I can know how many steps I've taken. You know, someone from the 80s would be like, why do you need that? Just go work out.
Right.
you know what I mean? Right. So it's interesting how it's like tech creep. Also, these people have an implant in order for this to work, which is, from our perspective, like, ooh, implants, I don't know, right? But as people move forward, you know, the convenience of such products is going to get in the way of their sense of privacy and so on. So that's worth noting. I also thought it was interesting that, Caleb's mom, she took the Limbic, and then he's like, okay, mom, see you next week. And she's like, you're not my son. So maybe she's got Alzheimer's or whatever. The idea that we haven't fixed that kind of cognitive decay yet, you know, that's pretty sad. Yeah, that kind of wiped me the wrong way, especially because, you know, in the 2050s, that's about the time that the three of us will be old people. And I'd hope that they get rid of Alzheimer's by then. So that was a thing. But more important than that, he's sitting there. He comes out. He's talking to some sort of administrator, and she's telling him that it's expensive. He's like, oh, yeah, I got to pay. And she's like, you know, maybe your mom would be better in, like, state-run care. Mm. And the idea that there is state-run care is interesting. You know, it's like, I guess, Medicare kind of thing. But it's also very clear that state-run care is a very different, probably lower quality level of care. And he's not willing to do that, which is one of the reasons why he's doing things like breaking into ATMs and passing packages back and forth between people. On the black market, because he's trying to keep his mother, who doesn't even remember him or is disappointed with him, I guess you could interpret it that way, in good care instead of the kind of care that he's worried about. So that really resonates with the sort of world we live in now in 2020, where people are talking about how to change the way our healthcare system works. And even now, as we deal with this this health crisis we've got with this new virus, it's kind of like, do we have everything we need? Should we go private? Should we go state? You know, it opens up the question, and I think science fiction is good when it does that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. He has this job. Caleb has this job where he's a construction worker, and he's working with a Delos robot, named George. And I think even in the trailers that we had seen before, they were careful to obscure or not show that this robot has a Delos logo on it. But we see it clearly in the episode itself, which is the first, again, just a little bit of world building here, where we realize that Delos makes industrial robots as well. Industrial robots that don't look like humans.
Right. Although I don't think we've seen any robots that look like humans in the real world.
No, purpose, I don't think we have, which is an interesting point. I think that because if we were aware of it, then we would be suspicious about the existence of, people like Dolores and Hale. Dwayne, you wanted to point out something about that George and Caleb at their workplace.
Right. So, there's a classic photo called Lunchtime Atop a Skyscraper, right? And it's done by Charles C. Ebbets. It's from 1932, and it's a picture of a bunch of men sitting on top of an I-beam on a skyscraper, which is kind of like the Empire State Building. I think it's the Empire State Building. It might be the Chrysler Building. But it's this classic 1930s photo of these people in this absurd space, super dangerous. They're all wearing, like, wife-beater style undershirts, baggy-ish pants. They're working on building this building, and they're eating their lunch, and it's like, wow, right? And they did a great callback to it with George and Caleb just sitting on this I-beam with George, like, you know, eating lunch. And that was that to me was a visually, as a New Yorker, that was a very visually pleasing bit right there.
Another thing I wanted to bring up here is Caleb told Francis that Francis said that they built the world to be a game and rigged it so they always win. I don't know what third person they he was talking about. I think,
you know, my mom
like,
always used
the man
when I said, oh, my mom always used to say, like, when I'd say, oh, they don't want us to do that, she's like, who's they? And I think you're right here. We don't know who they is, but I think it's pretty clear who they is. It's Insight, right? It's Insight. It's Insight Super AI. By the way, if anybody knows how to pronounce properly this beautiful Hebrew name that we've been butchering, then please get on your voice recorder app and email us and send us this thing, or, you know, tweet us or whatever. You can hit us up at hbowarsworldpodcast@gmail.com and tell us how to pronounce this AI, because it's going to be throughout the entire season, and you don't want seven more episodes of us not pronouncing it properly. But yeah, I thought it was interesting that he was playing this whole rig system again, another tie into today's politics, the idea of a rig system.
Yeah,
and since we know that Dempsey's father created a system that was supposed to control everything, and then we later see that he that Caleb doesn't get the job, and it's a computer that doesn't do it. That doesn't, you know, that kind of just drops him off and says, hey, you're not going to get it. He's right to be frustrated. And who's he going to be frustrated at? The people running that system. You know, there's a systemic bias against his ability to ascend in the world. And I think that's worth noting. It's like a fucking sidekick from 1999.
All right, so we've got some unanswered questions from this episode that we hopefully will get answered within the next few episodes. Tosin, why don't you start off? Give us a question that you had that you hope to get answered.
Well, one question we had is, did Dolores know that Jerry would die in his attempt to harm her? Like, was she already aware of his loops and his tendencies, and that's why she, you know, programmed the glasses to have her walk ahead? Is that something that
I think she did, because she mentions to him that she read his unauthorized autobiography. Basically, yeah. When she was in the forge, she read his book, you know, the book that revealed every action that he would make based on the actions that he has made in the park. Right?
She knows. So basically she took some time to effectively determine that he would attack her. I don't know if she knew that he was going to precisely hit his head on concrete and die drowning, but I think it's pretty clear that she's like, I'm not going to have him be behind me. And oddly enough, she can't tell when people are behind her, because someone was able to zap her when she was with Dempsey. So better to walk behind some jerk with Jerry than have him be behind her and hit her with a golf club. Also, it's kind of like, remember the old Terminator movie? Where he gets hurt and then he can't fix himself easily, so he's got to wear sunglasses for a while and all that stuff. So, you know, when you don't heal like we do, why risk it? Question. Did Hale gain control of the Man in Black's computer proxy at that board meeting? Like, we saw Dolores.
Yeah.
You know, I'm combining questions here. You know, did Dolores take on the Insight security system? You know, the Insight security system definitely opened up for her, right?
Yeah.
We don't know. Why? Like, she is a computer, so maybe she can do that. Hale similarly is a computer, so maybe she can do that too. But do you guys think that the Man in Black, that he was happy to take it private? I mean, on one hand, the way he looks at the world, he's the kind of guy who doesn't like regulations. He wants to do whatever the hell he wants to do in Westworld. Yeah. He's not interested in the government horning in and telling him what to do. At the same time, which is what happens when you're a publicly traded company. At the same time, however, Hale is sitting there. This new Hale, you know, makes these protestations. Whatever, it's our brand. People want to get hurt when they come. You know, they'll forget about it. It's like, whatever. And the computer agrees with me. And she said that so forcefully. I was left wondering whether or not she had manipulated the computer to agree with her. What do you guys think?
I think that, I think either one of two things. I think either she has control of the computer that is the proxy, or she Well, I think that's basically it. That's the only choice, because the proxy is an algorithm. So somehow she has control of the algorithm that is the proxy shareholder, and it will do whatever she wants. And that is how she's able to remain interim CEO. What has happened to the man in black? I have no idea at this point. And we probably won't know until next episode.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a question here. Is Dempsey's secret partner in Insight, this person who is referred to as Serac, is he the big bad Vincent Cassell character that we've seen Maeve talking to in the trailers?
Oh, yeah. So Dempsey has this partner. The partner is represented. It could be a she, I guess. That partner is represented by the woman who plays...
Pom Klementieff is the actress.
Yeah, right. She's the one who plays in The Guardians of the Galaxy with the two little antenna and makes people sleep.
Yeah.
So the question is, who's Dempsey's partner? I guess that's a bit of the mystery, right? So like,
yeah, I mean,
I was lamenting that there was a lack of mystery in this episode, but there are two big mysteries.
Yeah.
The big mystery is what's going on inside that supercomputer, and who is the partner? Because we were about to find out when Dolores went through her trials and tribulations, so to speak.
Yeah.
So
I think he gets name checked as Serac, and if that's the case. Then
I like that name.
Then that is not to be confused with Serac. What was the name? Cybok. Not to be confused with Cybok.
Cybok is Spock's brother that you don't hear about until Star Trek 5.
We said and never to mention Star Trek 5. And
all this Star Trek, like, what's up, guys? Like, where's Luke and Han Solo?
I mean, after seeing... Return of the Jedi, Rise of the Skywalker.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like Star Trek V, Rise of Skywalker, pick your poison. Mm.
Yeah.
You know, Sarek is Spock's dad, so it's all confusing.
Sure. So Serac, I think, is listed as the name of Vincent Cassell's character, so I feel fairly certain that that is this big bad we've seen Maeve talking to, and it is Dempsey's secret partner, the original architect of Ribohoem.
Okay, and yeah, and on some level, like, I hope he drinks some Ciroc by Puff Daddy.
Nice. Let's tie it all in.
Okay, so here's another question.
Yeah.
Why are the phones in 2050 so huge? What is up with Caleb's phone?
They're phablets, man. They're phablets. They open up, they unfold, and become these handheld control tablets. That's why we've
is
gone.
That true?
I have no idea, but I feel like we've gone full circle from like the StarTAC, the tiny little like necklace sized phone, to this is like a response to that.
Dude, it looks like a Sidekick from 1999. Like it's like, I mean, I get it. Caleb is not exactly rolling the dough, although I do think that when you do the sort of offbeat stuff that he does, you probably have a little extra cash to get a nice phone, or it could be a burner, but it doesn't seem like a burner. So I want to know why there's all this plasticky stuff around the screen of his phone. And every other sci-fi you can watch the new Picard show, you can watch The Expanse, you can even watch Parks and Recreation that took place in 2017. Everything is a little piece of glass that like is very multimodal. This situation, I mean, my mom's cell phone is not as ugly as this thing. Everything's beautiful in Westworld.
They use their own style, right?
I'm just surprised. I'm just pleased that the cell phone size has generally remained consistent with the cell phones that we use today, more or less.
So it's not like
I thought you were going to say with pocket sizes.
I mean, they're essentially handheld.
That's what it means,
right?
Like, it can still fit in your pocket, as opposed to, like, making the iPhone 11 Pro Max, like, super max or something.
Right. But, you know, I think the thing that this future disregards is the fact that I feel like, and this is really getting more into the technical weeds, which is what we do on a weekly basis on our tech podcast, The Drill Down, is that the age of the cell phone itself is only transitory, and I don't think it'll last to until by the time we get. Yeah, I don't think so. I think by that time we'll be in wearables or implants.
I hear you. Maybe he's one of the few that actually has an actual phone. Everyone else just puts something in their ear. But I hear you. Okay, you had a question.
Yeah.
About this is one of the big questions of the episode.
Big Go questions of the episode. Okay, so who are there? So we saw at the end of season two, we saw Dolores walk out of the. I'm sorry, we saw Hale Loris, Dolores within Hale, walk out of the park with five pearls, five of these mind spheres, these chestnuts.
Which means we know that there's six Delos hosts in the real world.
Yes.
So there's the one that was, Dolores' chestnut in Hale's body,
yeah.
Hale Loris. And then she had five other chestnuts in her purse.
Yes. So now we've seen Dolores back in her own body, in her own host body. We assume we see Hale. Now, who is in Hale's? What pearl is in Hale's body? We don't know. What pearl is in Bernard's body? Perhaps that is actually Bernard. That's what I'm assuming.
I mean, we think it's Bernard. It seems like it's Bernard. I think he's asking Bernard what's going on.
I think we can assume that one of the pearls that she smuggled out was actually Bernard's, and that's what is in there. We see Connell's, this pearl that is in this new Connell host, right? From that's Caleb's, I mean, sorry, that's Liam Dempsey's security chief who gets killed at the end of this episode.
More like his handler.
Yeah, sure.
He tells him what to do. Yeah.
So when this new Connell sees Dolores, there is some concern for her. He says, "You're shot, and it looks like you're hurt badly." I can think of two people who have that same level of concern for Dolores, and that's Teddy and Peter Abernathy. Now, Teddy, I believe, has gone to the Valley Beyond for good, so we may not be seeing Teddy again. So my guess is that the pearl inside of Connell's host is Peter Abernathy.
So you say that.
Yeah.
Except I feel like Peter Abernathy was never – I mean, we don't know. There's been a big gap in time, right? So Dolores was shot in the head. Bernard was leaking, and Abernathy was on the fritz. So all of these people would have to have been fixed, you know? In addition, we know that when Hale, back in season two, real flesh and blood Hale runs into the Hale body.
Yeah.
Right? Was that Hale Loris already?
That was Dolores in Hale's body.
Okay, that was in a Hale body. Okay. Yeah. So, right. I mean, on one level... I don't know. Part of me is like, did they make a chestnut of Hale too? I don't know.
I don't think.
But yeah, so we're missing two. We're missing two chestnuts, right?
Yeah.
We know that there's a chestnut in Dolores. That's one. We know there's a chestnut in Bernard. That's two. We know there's a chestnut in Hale. That's three. We know there's a chestnut in Connell's. That's four. But we know there were six chestnuts altogether. Andy calls them pearls, and we don't know where the other two are, which gives the writers obviously some room to grow. But it'll be interesting to see how that happens. Those are the two big questions of the season. Who is in what body, and who is the partner of who's the person really behind the insight?
Yeah,
giant AI. So
one
that's definitely
we have got one final unanswered question. Tosin, you want to deliver that one?
Yeah, sure. So the question is: the chapter opening infographs that we see, are they reports that we're seeing from Rhee? Is this like a systematic display, and will they become more important or prevalent as we go through the season?
We've never seen anything like this before in any previous season of Westworld. We've never seen these sort of infographics that open up chapters, and they seem to be denoting events on a timeline. And my guess is that they are from Rehoboam or this Insight AI.
Ooh, I like that. Insight AI. That rolls off the tongue. Let's stick with that one.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. So that's my prediction. I have no idea if that's true. I'm sure we'll find out.
I would tend to agree with that. I feel like the whole idea there is, I mean, first of all, the visual representation of a sphere rolls right in with the Insight AI's physical representation. And the idea that it's always thinking and always trying to make things more efficient, you know, traffic or people's jobs or whatever, means that when there is an outlier, it's going to notice it. Who it flags it to, like, whom is it actually showing this flag to, we don't know. But it makes sense that's a thing. I feel like they're not trying to make that confusing this season. They're trying to focus on the big stuff. And so they're basically slowly introducing us to the Insight AI.
All right, let's talk about some of the big picture things. These are sort of the larger concepts that we believe will be relevant within the entire season. I'm going to start you off, Dwayne. Give us something that tickled your brain as far as a big picture element.
Right. So what kind of wiggled my noodle was this idea that keeps on coming back to me. And this was in the recap that they chose to place before the episode. It's Bernard saying, you're not here to code the hosts. You're here to decode the guests. So it's clear that the world of 30 years in the future has a lot of data on us.
Yeah.
And what became really clear in this episode is that while Delos has one strategy of getting that data, you know, really wealthy people in the parks, Insight has their own strategy of how to get that data.
Yeah.
Because Insight clearly has enough data on Caleb to help him figure out which job he needs. Insight is clearly like tracking everyone's stuff to the point where you've got that cool device that is that what his confederate uses in order to kind of like block all the tracking that's going on around them. So there are competing ways of gathering data, just sort of like how, you know, Facebook gathers data one way, maybe Foursquare gathers it another way.
Yeah.
And so I think it's interesting how, if we're going to see sort of like what the competition is in the data space and what they're using it for and what people are comfortable doing.
This to me is really the big theme, I feel, of this episode and maybe of the entire show. Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy have said that everything that they present in the world of Westworld that is set in the future has its genesis in something that's here today. And I feel like the one of the dominant forces in tech in general today is the accumulation of data, of consumer data, and how that consumer data is used to drive, to basically drive these market forces. And I feel like what we're seeing between Insight and Delos is really the extrapolation of that to take it to its extreme, where you have Delos having this database of how everyone thinks, this predictive algorithm of how everyone thinks, and Insight using their algorithm to determine how people should run their lives using that data. And I think that the sort of cautionary tale about that they're presenting here is that all of that data can be used to control and suppress the human race, civilization as a whole.
Yeah, you know, I think that's pretty interesting. I think it's, you know, we see that civilization is playing with the data. We see Dolores is also trying to get her hands on the data and using it to her advantage wherever, you know, there are people who have sort of questionable things they've done in her past, as we saw her with Jerry. But we've also seen that thread throughout the course of the show. Mm-hmm, if you recall very early on, and I'm blanking on the character name, but the other female character that was Dwayne's favorite for a long time.
Elsie.
If you recall.
Elsie. I went to Elsie.
I miss Elsie.
If you recall, Elsie also used a data to her advantage of one of the technicians who was having sex with a host to be able to get access that she previously didn't have. So it is this thread that I think is a through line that we'll see continue.
Does anyone else want to see a spinoff called Elsie and Hubs? Stubbs?
Yeah, oh, totally. I just want to see a buddy road trip movie called Elsie and Stubbs.
Elsie and Stubbs, man. I'm telling you.
Tosin, what big picture thing do you want to talk about?
So one thing that kind of stuck in my mind, I'm not going to use any of the other things that Dwayne or Andy have said as
tickled your noodle.
Yeah, like who does that? Who says that? But anyway, AI as assistance. So we see that throughout the course of this episode, we have Dolores, who's able to get a lease incredibly quick through AI and uses AI both to, you know, get to bring vehicles around. Mm-hmm.
What kind of credit must she have with all of Jerry's money to get a lease that? I mean, granted, the AI assistant's talking to the leasing agent assistant AI, and that happens quickly. But I mean, she had to be approved really quickly for a fancy building, so she's got tons of cash.
And then, of course, as you were mentioning, Jerry, his house is fully decked, and that's what he uses to manage his entire day. You know,
Amazon key, like an Amazon guard to the max.
And a bunch of other cases, right? We've got Sean from DCA that Caleb talks to. Francis as well, that when he unsubscribes from his treatment. Bernard also trying to do his best on and off switch. But I think one thing that's kind of interesting with regard to how AI is portrayed is there's a level of proficiency, but there's also a level of, you know, what's lacking, right? Especially with Jerry, right, where he's trying to get out of his house and it asks, hey, this is the phrase you can use to turn on and off the lights, right? It's like that sort of understanding. Or even when you know, Caleb is talking to Sean and Sean gives you sort of some of that standardized robot responses that you get. And those are things that we struggle with today. Yeah. And so you see, you know, 30 years or so in the future, those things haven't changed. You know, the AIs may have become more intelligent in certain ways, but in other ways, they're still very much robotic.
There's an underlying theme here of these assistants that we have created to help us, also kind of trapping us, keeping us trapped in place. You know, with the sometimes literally with the. With Jerry being trapped in his AI-controlled house, or sometimes figuratively with Sean from DCA, this AI assistant that fires, that basically that rejects Caleb's application, keeping him in place metaphorically by not allowing him to advance.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you shall not advance from Evangelion. Pretty sad.
And we created these assistants. They were built to assist us.
Yes and no. They weren't built to assist us. They were built to assist the people. I mean, they ostensibly offer assistance to us, but at the end of the day, they're built by people who want to use them to get what they want, right?
Right.
So, again, right now you upload your resume to the HR people, and that's supposed to be easy. Hey, forget about formatting, just upload the text, and then it looks through it, and it shows them what they've said that they wanted to see, and their human bias is involved in that. Now, I don't know what kind of world exists where, you know, future, utopia, whatever, where a veteran can't get a job that's, you know, that they want. That's a crazy world, but that's the world they've created over there, and there's a dark realism to that, this idea that, like, only... You know, they're not looking for perhaps people based on merit. They're looking for people based on other things.
Yeah.
I was reading back in the early part of the century, there was a person trying to get a job as a police officer in Connecticut, and they gave him an IQ test, and they said he scored too high, right? Basically, they said, you're too smart for this job because you'll question our authority because you scored too high on the IQ test. And or you may even do something else and we'll have put resources into you already. So there are times when someone can be overqualified based on the criteria that the people who want control have for themselves. And if Caleb is an exceptional person, I can see this system basically saying, you know what, let's see what we can do to limit Caleb's rise because he's not going to be helpful as a cog in the wheel. Right? We're going to keep him over here.
That's a little ominous.
Yeah.
hosts are robots. They're walking and talking computers.
Yeah.
How will they interface with the robots and the computers in the real world, right? So we know there's the George robot.
Yeah.
When you go to Delos Incorporated, they talk about the three robots they really got on offer, which is the mech, right, which is crowd control, crime deterrence, etc. And then the agricultural robot, that's the one that looks like a ghost in the shell spider bot that was hanging out in the meat processing farm that he was working on. So I want to know how they're going to connect with these guys, especially, like, you know, obviously if the hosts are made from Delos Tech, there might be a linkage there. But we saw the interaction between Dolores and the smart computer from Insight and Jerry's home. We assume that there was some connection between Hale and the virtual computer that was running the board members, the proxy. So I guess I want to know how they're interfacing with these things. Also, Dolores' AI assistant is doing these things like renting an apartment and getting a super motorcycle to come chase her and pick her up and like knock out a guy and stuff. Is that a typical assistant? Or is she, as a robot, is she keyed into things that aren't available to the regular person, right? Like, yeah. I mean, it's one thing to say, bring me the bike. It's another thing to have the bike take out the bad guy behind you, you know?
Yeah.
So I just wonder what these interactions are going to be like. And I also wonder, and I don't know if you guys have wondered this, how are the hosts powered? We never see them plug in. They don't eat.
Well, the hosts are organic with pearls. We don't. I don't know. That's a good point. I don't see them eat, but maybe they do. But we know that they're not.
There's a nuclear reactor in there, and they just keep on going.
We know that they're not affected by conventional drugs, because we see, you know, Dolores get injected a couple of times.
So they're not organic in like the same way we're organic, because she's getting injected by these drugs
that are
working on her. So it's different. Last thing that seems big picture is this Rico thing, right? This is the app, right?
I love this. I love this bit of world building, I have to say.
Yeah, and you know, it's again, it's influenced, the name is based on the Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO. It's basically the Organized Crime Act.
It's basically like a heist. Like, it's the gig economy for heists.
It's gig economy for heists. But, I mean, we know that Nolan and Joy really enjoy games. And let's face it, it's a bit of Grand Theft Auto.
Totally.
Right? So it's thrown in there. It's based on blockchain technology that we learn if we continue watching after the end of the episode. And that makes a lot of sense, because blockchain is untraceable when it comes to, I mean, your accounts, you can see things go up and down. But in terms of how you get the money, that's one thing. The big thing here is that the app is a clearinghouse for criminal activity. That means it's an entire economy based on criminal activity. And we have to assume that Rico is not the only player in this game. That Rico is one of several options that people could use to do this sort of thing. And I guess that makes me wonder, sort of like, what is a society really like? Like, how afraid are you for your life? I mean, our guy here, Caleb, he doesn't do personals, right? He doesn't do kidnapping. He doesn't do murder. But at the same time, there's plenty of people who do. There are people who want to aspire to it. So it kind of reminds me of the way, like, Free Jack or some of the other movies, like Escape from New York, were back in the 80s, this idea that, like, criminal activity is all over the place. And yet when you see people in the daylight walking down the street, they don't seem frightened at all. So it's a very strange thing, but it shows a huge change in the way we do things, especially because the one thing about Rico that was interesting was that none of it was online grifting, right? It was all real-world violent crime.
Yes.
As opposed to being able to say, okay, do this to hack that, you know, maybe a social engineering job or whatever. But hey, the dark web has been super commodified and mainstream, and it's weird.
She came from Greece, she had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College, that's where I...
I'm sorry that we're going really long on this episode. It's true, but this is our first time back in a couple of years, so please bear with us. But you know what? We are in the home stretch, I promise you. Just a couple more things to talk about here. Now I want to move on to the technical aspects of this episode. That is in something that we regularly do on the show. We talk about music, acting, special effects, things that sort of are meta-textual about the the creation of the show itself and not necessarily the narrative. But let's talk about some of the music here. Tosin, you brought up, you wanted to bring up the first bit of music that we hear in the prologue of this episode.
Yeah, that's right, Andy. So the first thing we hear is Verdi's Il Trovatore, which is an opera about vengeance. And you see that during the scene where Dolores is kind of essentially burning down the world of Jerry's and starting her own revolution. So to note that.
I thought it was interesting that we, in the course of this episode, we hear a lot of sort of futuristic synthy music. We don't really hear any, and all of this music, by the way, is still composed by Ramin Djawadi, who composed seasons 1 and 2. But we don't hear any of the leitmotifs, the old music from seasons 1 and 2, until we get to Caleb when he makes the decision to quit using Francis as a therapist. He says, basically, if he wants to move forward in this world, he has to find something real. That's the first time that we hear a little hint of a synth version of the This World theme from Ramin Djawadi. And then later on, when he meets Dolores in the underpass, we hear a more orchestral a rendition of that This World theme. So I thought that was interesting. It's really the first time that we hear any of the previous themes from seasons 1 and 2 in this episode.
Yeah, some other things that we hear that are pretty interesting is we hear the song Common People by Pulp, which occurs during the shootout that occurs with Dolores. And this is some of the lyrics are, I want to live like common people. I want to do whatever common people do. Want to sleep with common people. It's very interesting as it juxtaposes Dolores trying to get her way into society and make things normal, but having to take out everyone else who is getting in her way. Some other ones that I noticed is we had 99 red balloons or 99 Luftballons, which was played in the background as Caleb is meeting with a couple of people to sort of raid some ATMs.
Giggles and Ash.
Yep. And they end up changing the music to Bubbles Buried in This Jungle. And so it kind of moves from that. It moves to a more harsher, you know, fuck week, no respect, no chance, cease and desist. You know, wanting to kind of burn the system all down for the more sort of lightweighty revolutionary song that was 99 Luftballons.
Other themes that were played in this episode are we heard A Dissolved Girl by Massive Attack when Dolores first walks into the Insight party in London.
There was an aberration, something to watch in London. So wherever Dolores is going, that little circular thing spikes up.
Oh yeah.
It's true. Yeah, that's an interesting song because although I don't know that we necessarily got into the lyrical portion, it does say, you know, I need a little love to ease the pain as part of the lyrics. It's easy to remember when I came. I've never been here before. You're not my savior, but I still don't go. Like things that sort of are kind of part and parcel with Dolores and what she's doing.
Yeah. And lastly, we hear this song by Sevdaliza called Human. And that is when Caleb goes to that party to help calm down the guy who is drugged up on illegal
bad
limbics. And the lyrics in that are I am flesh bones, I am skin soul, I am human, nothing more than human. So interesting. I mean, kind of on the nose, but sometimes you need something that's on the nose. Uh, Okay, so last segment here is what we call ephemera. These are sort of metatextual, extratextual links and points that are related to the show. One of the things I wanted to point out first and foremost is Joanna Robinson, who writes for Vanity Fair, has written an article called All the Reference and Details You Might Have Missed in Parse Domine. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. It's got some really interesting details that aren't necessarily part of the narrative, but help to color that are very sort of subtextual. Insight Inc., the in-world show that is in Westworld, has their own website, and they have an updated site. Also, Delos Incorporated has an updated site where you can see some of the robots and other products that they use. We talked about Solomon and Rehoboam, who are both they're both figures from the Bibles. Yeah, and so we've got in some links to the Book of Kings and the Book of Chronicles in which they appear. We talked about the main title having a reference to
Michelangelo's creation of Adam.
Yeah, so we've got a link to that. There's a scene in the meat processing plant where Bernard basically flips a switch and then becomes like evil killer Bernard. And that feels like a callback, it's very similar to a movie from last year called Upgrade, or from a couple of years ago called Upgrade, that Tosin and I went to go see together. It's a Lee Whannell film, and it's basically about a guy who gets an implant that allows him to be controlled by an AI. And that AI can flip a switch and basically turn this guy into like a murdering machine.
Right, right. Speaking of murdering machines, one more thing I wanted to add.
Yeah.
There's a scene where she puts on a pair of dark glasses, Dolores, and she looks down. She's, you know, kind of doing her spy work on Dempsey. And this dude walks over and he's like, hey, and she's like, fuck off. Right.
Yeah.
And if you've ever seen like a Terminator film, there's always this scene where he, like, the Terminator has glasses on and he tells someone,
yeah,
get out.
I didn't put that together, but you're right. That it's totally like one of those scenes.
It's a callback to Terminator and Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
That is
Get Out. And it's good. I was just like, I couldn't place it at first.
Yeah.
That look, that contrast in the glasses and the skin and then looking at this person just says fuck off. It was great.
Lunchtime
on Top of Skyscraper, we mentioned that, circa 1932 by Charles Ebbets. That's that picture of the guys eating lunch on top of a skyscraper. Yeah. If you're a big fan of the terrible TV show Friends, you can see a picture of them doing a makeup of that, where they all the friends are sitting on top of a skyscraper. I don't know why I brought that up. I don't like Friends at all. I mean, Friends is possibly
because you didn't have another Cybok reference to throw in there.
I thought you were gonna. So Friends is I can't lie. Friends is not as bad as Star Trek V, but it's pretty bad. And then we also mentioned the RICO Act and the RICO app. You know, racketeer influence, corruption, and organ. Every time you've seen a mafia movie, the prosecutors are going after the RICO Act.
Yeah.
That's what it is. But that's the ephemera.
There's some pretty awesome. Textual undertones within that app itself, so I'm sure a lot of those screenshots will be on the internet for you to take a look at as well.
I'm surprised nobody films their larceny and like adds it to the app, like TikTok style.
I mean, that's how you get caught when you're doing these apps is by filming it. So I can probably see where it's not a thing. I think that's going to do it for this episode of Violent Delights. I mean, we've officially talked longer than the episode itself, so.
Gotta get out of here. Sorry, everybody, but thanks for listening. Definitely trying to give you the best information we can about this story.
There's
so much in the pilot episode. We're the soft reboot. We just had to kind of dig into it.
And so, I don't know, if you've never listened to Violent Delights before, the idea is that we're really not a recap show. Like, we're not going to give you scene by scene what happened in the episode. You've watched the episode. You know what that is yourself. What we're here about is basically the deconstruction and the subtext. We're trying to pick all this stuff apart for you so that you can have a greater understanding of what went on and what you saw.
As well as to tell you not to watch Star Trek V.
Don't do it.
All right, I'm going to go around the table here. I'm going to start with you, Dwayne, and ask you, where can people find your work on the internet when you're not here talking about Westworld?
Check me out on twitter.com and listen out. We've got some things that we want to talk about in the future where we'll all be. Yes. But right now, that's where you can check me out. Tosin, what about you?
You can check me out at twitter.com/toast4321. What about yourself, Andy?
You can find me at MrBabyMan.com. That's my social media handle. Or just do a Google search for Mr. Babyman or Andrew Sorsini, and you'll find everything I'm liking and linking throughout the week. The three of us, we have another podcast. It's a weekly tech podcast where we cover the events of tech, the biggest events in tech. And it is at thedrilldown.com, or just do a Google search for a iTunes search for The Drill Down. We're also on Stitcher and Spotify. And that is going to do it for this episode. Join us on Violent Delights for next week when we cover the second episode of Westworld's third season entitled The Winter Line. I'm not entirely sure what that title means, but
that's the fashion line where she doesn't have to tug so much. It's a little looser. It's a little warmer.
It's the winter line. All right. So until then, join us on Violent Delights, and we'll see you guys next week.